Coming up, you'll be sifting through Grandma's fine china looking for clues to a long-forgotten fortune after this. Just bring heat and lemon water. It's National Treasure, and this is Most Extreme Podcast.
Welcome to Most Extreme Podcast, the show where we discuss and analyze the enigma that is 2000s pop culture. I'm Jonathan Snowdy.
I'm Brett Ellison.
And I'm Jarrett Whitworth.
Oh, me? Oh, yeah. And today we are talking the 2004 smash blockbuster hit, National Treasure, which I'm sure most of us have some background on. Dead faces. Okay.
No, absolutely.
Oh, really? Oh, sweet. Well, I'm excited to talk about it.
I'm so excited to talk about it.
Okay, I know that Jarrett is because he's been planning about this to talk about this for a while, but thank you for listening. It's not over yet, but I'm just saying thank you to all our listeners. And but yeah, and also if you're new, thanks for much for listening. And we have our guest with us. You know him from CW's Legacies, and also he's the host of Cover to Cut podcast. Very good podcast. Check it out. Elijah Moore is here.
Hello.
Elijah Moore
Thank you guys for having me.
Thank you for coming.
Absolutely.
We were talking not too long ago. Actually, I should give a clarification to people who have already listened to our podcast. A story that actually came up on our Shrek 2 episode is, and you'll probably know exactly what I'm talking about, Elijah, once I start saying this, is that I gave it a story about, I did this play of The Hobbit. I did this play of The Hobbit, and in which we did it, and I was like in a summer camp, and
started on a Monday and performed on Friday,
right?
So 1 week,
very like cram session type play of The Hobbit, and we were doing the performance of the play in which an actor started doing a scene that we cut from the show. And that was Elijah. So to give some clarification on
that
on
was
what
yeah,
was going on.
And I still occasionally because a form of that theater company still runs. Now, obviously, they didn't do anything this summer, but they've asked me to go and like help with accent work or do some acting coaching or something. And they always ask me to tell that story.
Really? Oh, man.
Every time I go. And they say, this is why it's important to read the script and pay attention and not just read the script the night. Because that's what I did. I only read the script the night before the show. So when the show was going and I didn't realize we had cut this scene, I was like, wait, I'm the only one that can save this. And yeah.
So we improvised the entire scene. It was incredible. One of the best moments. But now you're, gotten a lot of success from doing acting and you're
somehow.
Yeah. And you're definitely one of the funniest people I like talking to.
Oh,
so I'm
thanks.
Glad you're here. But we were talking about sort of topics and movies and stuff to talk about. And you mentioned National Treasure. Do you have like a personal background with the movie at all?
I mean, I loved it. And it definitely kind of awoken the conspiracy theorist in me when I was, gosh, how old was I? 8 when this movie came out. And I started looking like very closely at the back of the dollar bill, being like, where's the secret code? And
nice.
We went on a trip. My family went on a trip to Philadelphia when I was younger and saw like the Liberty Bell and all those things. And I kept wanting and playing out in my head, like, how would I steal this?
Some kid, like, moving his hands back and forth, looking at the Liberty Bell. What am
you
I going to do?
It'll be mine.
Steal the Liberty Bell.
Okay, I should give. I worked at a summer camp not too far from Philadelphia, and the Liberty Bell is a waste of time, people.
Oh, yeah.
You can see it from the window. So
it's super. I do have one funny story about when we went there, though, because I can't remember how old I was, but I was young enough where photo bombing was the funniest thing to me. And so, like, we took our picture, our family took our picture in front of the Liberty Bell, and then, you know, we just kind of were standing off to the side looking at other stuff, reading plaques or whatever. And this other family was standing in front of the Liberty Bell taking a picture. So I was like, I'm going to join in on this random family's picture. And so I jump in next to the dad. I like put my arm around him and I point at him. And some of them kind of like laugh or chuckle or whatever. And the dad just gives me a death glare. Like he looks over at me and he's just like staring at me, like confused and angry. And I kept waiting for him to break, like be like, I'm just kidding, whatever. But he didn't. He just kept glaring at me and then looked back at the camera and smiled again.
Wow.
But so that made it a memorable trip to the Liberty Bell. But otherwise, yeah, it's fine. It's
and,
a bell.
And that family still has that framed above their mantle. Jared, Jonathan, y'all have a background with National Treasure, the movie?
I'm sure I saw it in theaters. You said 04.
Yeah, November 04.
Yeah, so I would have been like almost 12. I remember we were eighth graders on a field trip. Whatever year that would have been, the movie would have been out for just a few years or a couple of years at that point. And in the movie, they make reference to like eighth graders on their DC trip,
right?
So anyway,
they all look like they're six.
And, yeah. it's like part of the security he's laying out. He's like, right. They have cameras and guards and eighth graders on a field trip.
As if they're going to talk into their digital watches, like, all right, guys, we think we got them.
But they like tackle them to the ground.
I want to see that in the next Bond film. He's sneaking in a bunch of Boy Scouts. Oh, God.
On the way to our eighth grade field trip to DC, we're like a couple hours out. And the teacher, like, it's on one of those charter buses that has the TV screens and you can play VHS and whatever. And he says, all right, like, we're getting pretty close. So we thought that we would just pop in this educational documentary. And, like, you could hear the air just go out of the bus. Everyone's like, oh, my gosh, this is a bus ride. Like, and then National Treasure comes up. Like, the opening credits were all, the whole bus erupted. Yes!
That's awesome.
So you were on your way to D.C., and was it your teacher?
Yeah, and we watched National Treasure on the way.
All right, listen, we're on our way to D.C. We're going to hit the LZ in about 20 minutes. Here's the mission briefing. Yeah, yeah.
Here's your real education.
Get your notes out.
This is what they won't tell you on the tour.
Team B, you're going to go this route.
Who has a $100 bill with them right now? We're going to need to know the time.
We're going
to
steal the Declaration of Independence.
Jonathan, do you have any background?
Yeah, my family had this on DVD for the longest time, so I've seen it at least four or five times, probably.
Okay. Did you have the classic two-disc special edition DVD?
No. I found out when I was researching for this that we have it in... we have the one disc, and it's the 2005, like, full screen. So it's like the 4x3. Oh, no. Like, it was very sad.
See, I always preferred full screen as a kid because I thought it was the reverse. I thought widescreen, they cut off the top and bottom because it was like the bar, because we had, you know, a square TV back then. And so I think, like Star Wars Episode II, I have only the full screen version, which if you're not going to watch one of the Star Wars movies, that's a good one to skip. But it's still like I just have this random selection of full screen movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it was a long time, I think, before my family got a widescreen TV. Like I'm pretty sure my grandparents were throwing away their old one. And they, like, brought it up from Florida. And they were like, you guys need this.
Nice. Mm.
So your grandparents had two full-screen TVs, widescreen TVs.
They had one. You guys had one. Yeah, they had one, and they replaced it. And they felt so bad for us. They were like, listen, you guys.
Also, have you heard of DSL internet?
What's the internet?
My personal, I do love this movie. I watched it a lot as a kid. I have the two disc special edition, which is such a weird saying now. I love it. I actually had a birthday party. I think it was my ninth birthday party, and it was a sleepover party. And we watched National Treasure, so I've seen it multiple times.
Oh, I thought you were gonna say you had a National Treasure themed birthday party. No,
very sweet. Like, all right, everybody, get out the lemon juice.
Time to jump into the Hudson River.
But I keep forgetting things about this movie because I think like I watched it maybe like 2-3 years ago and then watching it for this. But I keep forgetting things, like, especially now, like I forgot that Christopher Plummer was in the movie until watching it again. I was like, wait, what? He's in this? I definitely probably didn't recognize him as a kid. But then, like, stuff like I didn't remember anything on the aircraft carrier. Like that part, I just keep forgetting stuff like that.
I guess when I was a kid, didn't realize like just how much they tell, what's Diane Kruger's name?
Abigail.
Yeah. How much Ben Franklin Gates tells her to shut up the entire movie.
Yeah.
That's like most of their dialogue.
Yeah.
Cause he's like, stop talking. Shut up. She won't close her mouth.
Now,
this
is actually quite funny because even though this episode is not out in November, we happen to be recording this a day after the Honest trailer for National Treasure came out.
Yeah.
So some Which of my notes crazy. Might be from that. Yeah.
Yeah. And what's funny is, yeah, I just saw that last night and I was like, oh, wow, that's oddly coincidental.
Yeah.
And he made a joke in that I made to my roommate when I was watching it. And then I saw him make the joke. I was like, dang it. Now it's just going to seem like I'm stealing it.
Can I talk about how this movie got made a little bit? I have Please. A little bit of the history backstory a little bit. But so essentially the idea came from in the 90s from the Disney marketing head, Oren Aviv. And they had sort of gone through the idea. It's just an idea that they had. And then they had hired multiple different screenwriters. Up to like nine were hired between 1999 and 2003. Wow. Trying to streamline the story. And the idea was originally just about a person named Benjamin Franklin Gates stashing the riches of Benjamin Franklin, and the Freemasons were sort of involved. But yeah, so it went through a bunch of different drafts. Finally, they began shooting it and getting ready for it in like the summer of 2003, and they had screenwriters Marianne and Cormac Wibberly, which I think they're like a married couple writing thing that happens a lot.
Yeah, and they're credited as like the Wibberlys.
Right, yeah. And then they brought on John Turteltaub, I think, is his name, to direct. He has also directed the classic Cool Runnings.
Dude, he is a varied filmography. I looked him up after watching
it. He most recently directed The Meg. So, very different filmography. If shout out to The Meg. Shout out to our
Megalodon
listeners. and what else did he direct? He directed The Sorcerer's Apprentice, another one with Nick Cage. He directed, of course, National Treasure 2, and
he did the movie Phenomenon. Have you ever seen that?
No.
Who's the freaking, why am I blanking on his name? Travolta. Guy from Greece. Travolta. Thank you. Yeah. Again, not a great movie at all, but it's like dumb fun.
Okay.
And like a bunch of people make really stupid decisions, but it's just like, yeah, just sit along for the ride, and it's a fun one.
Gotcha. Yeah, so Turteltaub was, he spent 3 years in development in this movie before they actually began production, and he was the one who sort of was trying to get Nick Cage to get in it and saying, like, he was worth the wait to get. They actually went to high school together, Nicolas Cage and Turteltaub. And so they were both excited to work together. So Cage had said that making the movie, like, was a lot of fun because they had sort of that energy that, like, they knew each other ahead of time. So you have the star and the director, so having that already work was also great. But Cage has said that he did not plan on National Treasure being a hit. Like, there's like, I had no clue. We all thought, like, acting that it was not going to be a big movie. And it ended up being way bigger than they thought it was. So that's, it's definitely interesting watching that when you're like, none of these people think this is going to be a hit when they're acting this
Which
out.
You hear that so much. Like,
oh, sure.
In Cary Elwes's autobiography about Princess Bride, that was all they're thinking. Is they were like, yeah, this is fun, this is silly, but what is it? And then it came out and like no one saw it.
Right.
And then it released on rentals and blew up. And he said, like, I was walking down the street and someone was like, oh my gosh, you're Wesley. And he was like, who? Like, sorry, like he had forgotten about it. And then it became this huge, I love hearing when people in like these classic movies, I'll hesitate to call National Treasure a classic yet.
Sure. Oh. We can talk about that.
Oh, do you I don't hesitate to call it a
rebuttal? Okay.
Yeah. You have some opinions in here.
I have some qualms. I will say.
Okay.
But it's not a perfect.
There's only one part of the movie that I think is bad.
Okay.
And we'll get to it.
More on that later. Okay. Stay tuned.
Yeah.
But yeah. National Treasure was released in November 19th, 2004. We'll get to some of that later. But it continues to have a Rotten Tomatoes score of 46%.
That's too low.
Way too low.
That's way too low.
Is that a critic score or audience score?
Yeah, critic score.
It's critic score.
That's, again, it's not a perfect movie, but I rewatching it yesterday, I was like, this is legitimately a good little romp.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
They're stealing the frickin' Declaration of Independence. That's totally ludicrous.
Right.
But it's just embrace that.
Right, yeah. The first rough cut of the movie was 4 hours long.
Release the Turteltaub cut.
Which, okay, going on that, they are doing extensive reshoots for the Snyder cut or whatever for the Justice League. I don't even think it's a new cut anymore. It's just a different movie.
It's just a new movie.
We're just making a new
movie. A new movie that I cannot wait to watch all 5 hours of.
Now that, like, yeah, Jared Leto's in it now as the Joker, it's like, it's like, this is a new movie. Don't call it a different cut. Yeah, really
gotta sink your teeth into that.
But yeah, so one big thing that they had up their sleeve was using, oh, why can't I remember the guy's name? I'm sorry, why am I saying? Oh, Jerry Bruckheimer, having him involved as producing it, because I'm sure we'll get to a little bit later, but he, of course, had produced the year before this Bad Boys 2, probably the best film of all time, should have won the Palme d'Or, but we'll get to it. We will do a Bad Boys 2 episode. Okay, Jonathan, have you not seen? I'm sure you haven't seen Bad Boys
2. Of course I haven't.
Okay.
Jonathan hasn't seen the second half of Home Alone. He hasn't. Of course he hasn't seen Bad Boys 2.
Okay, sometimes Jonathan will beat me to things and he's seen it and I haven't.
Like surprising, Legally Blonde.
Like our Legally Blonde episode that came out.
I had even seen the musical.
I've never seen it.
I've listened to the musical, but I haven't seen the musical.
Yeah.
The musical's really good.
Which is a weird little niche to be in.
It was a high school performance and it was good, which was surprising.
See, the weirdest thing I ever saw was a high school performance of Rent. It was at Durham School of the Arts, and that's a movie about a group of people, multiple of which have AIDS and are drug users, and one's a stripper. And they kept in the song where she's, like, doing the striptease. And I was in high school at the time, so I was kind of like, this is awesome. But in retrospect, I'm like, how could that get approved?
But yeah, so Jonathan, you have to watch Bad Boys 2. I am not kidding. It is one of the best action movies of all time. All
right, let's go.
But the big thing about, so Jerry Bruckheimer, I mean, he recently, of course, did the Pirates for the first Pirates movie. So they're really big on his production company being like, if we can do it in live action, let's do it. And we'll make it as big as possible, which we'll talk about, of course, like with, you know, they blow up the Charlotte and they, like a million explosions. So like, He did like all the Michael Bay, like The Rock, and he did, you know, like you worked on Con Air, Black Hawk Down. So all these, like, they get the action stuff really right, and so it's a company you want to be working with.
And but, this, I will get into it. I was just going to say, I love the chase scene in Philadelphia in this movie. I forgot that it's a really great chase scene.
Me too.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And the soundtrack for that bit, that's like my favorite bit of the soundtrack.
Yeah. The soundtrack is extremely underrated for National Treasure.
Yes.
So it's weird because it comes out at the same time. It's like, you know, like Hans Zimmer becomes huge and you've got like, like the Pirates soundtrack, for example, and like all these big soundtracks kind of like Lord of the Rings, you know, all at the same time. And yet no one talks about this one, which I'm like, it's just as solid as the rest of them. But yeah, no. One of the things that also I think is really cool is, when they were trying to make this movie is that they had to rewrite it so many times, mainly because the original security system at the National Archives, when they were trying to sell the Declaration of Independence, had been used since 1957. What? So it was pretty easy for them to steal it. And then 9/11
happened.
They
pretty much just walked up and took it.
Yeah.
$20 handshake with the guard.
And then you take it. But then 9/11 happened, so they had to completely change the whole system. So while they were rechanging the system is when they were filming the movie. So they had worked with cops who were experts on breaking and entering to help them, like, kind of figure out using the actual security system, like, how they would go around using
Interesting.
It. So it is, like you were saying, like a field trip, like a how-to in a way.
And I always wonder whenever it's these in-depth look at real places and their security system, like, how accurate is it, I guess? You know, like, could someone feasibly do what they did in the movie with the same thing? I mean, obviously, like, getting the thumbprint from the glass and little stuff like that, knowing her password on the key thing.
All we need to do is find a national archivist who's missing one of George Washington's campaign buttons.
Exactly, and bribe them. But, like, is that the actual security system they have in place or had in place, at least at that time? Because that seems like such a, like, a national security threat of advertising in a movie. This is how to do it.
Like the History Channel where it's like, here's the secret button that blows up our tanks. Yeah. You know,
like, let's
hope they don't get this channel.
Apparently the government was super easy and like gave them the blueprints for like the building to make this movie for the production design. Because, and we'll get into later, of course, because like the big thing that they like kind of prided themselves on was filming like on location for this movie for a lot of it. However, when I was a kid, I did go to DC and we went to the National Archives. And the last thing that our tour guide said in the National Archives was, "And National Treasure was not filmed here." And I was like, "But the behind the scenes said it was."
How you get a lot of really disappointed kids.
I did read though that this was the first time that the inside of Independence Hall was used in film.
Yes.
So like it wasn't the National Archives, but it was like, and so and it is actually a really poignant scene when he uses the glasses, and we'll talk about that. But I thought that was super neat of like, oh wow, they actually filmed in there.
Yeah.
And it was the first time they filmed in there. That was something else.
Yeah. And when he's like, you know, the last time this was here of being signed, even though of course it's not the real
right, yeah. But it still is just kind of like a moment. Yeah. Like, oh wow.
Have y'all seen the Declaration of Independence in real life?
I must have.
I think I might have.
I mean,
we went to DC. Actually, no, I do remember because I did see it, and I remember. How can you read this thing? Because it's like so faded.
Right.
It's been around for so long. It's like, yeah, dude, okay. Is this the back?
Yeah. I'm glad someone
put some lemon juice on it.
Someone thought to like write down what it said in more modern script, so it's not like, yeah, this is what we based our Constitution on. Don't know what it says, but apparently it was pretty important roughly 200 years ago.
Well, we know who John Hancock is, but I don't know who the rest is. But yeah, no, I think it's interesting how much they've kind of worked with it. Now, I'm trying to like remember it, like at the very beginning of the movie, Christopher Plummer sort of explains what the treasure is, mm-hmm. but so essentially the treasure was basically something that's just been fought over for like centuries. Is that right?
It's a gradual accumulation
exactly
of different
battles and wars. You have the Babylonians that like steal treasure from people, and then the Assyrians come in, wipe them out, and they take all the treasure. So each time, like, it gets fought over and stolen again, it gets bigger.
And then eventually it was when the Templars found it.
Yeah.
And they were like, this is too much for one person to have. We've got to...
So we're going to hold on.
We've got to
hide it. So we're going to hide it.
So we're going to take it.
Or actually, no, I'm sorry. I think I'm conflating that with the second one. Is the second one where, like, the big thing is... This is too much for one.
No,
that's
the first
that's
one.
In the first one. Yeah, that's in the first one. Where, they're like, this is too much for one man.
Right.
That's when they quote unquote form the Knights Templar.
Right.
Yeah. When they're all like, bro, you see this treasure?
Which,
hey, Bobby.
Also, coincidentally,
dap me up with the sword.
My roommate just watched Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade a few nights ago, and that's also all about Templar stuff. And,
right.
And
yeah.
The Holy Grail. Yeah. So I kept waiting for like the temple or the Holy Grail or like the Ark of the Covenant to like show up or something in the treasure. It's like, wow, what is this box? I don't know.
Let's open it. No, but it's interesting how they kind of talk about the Knights of Templar and then turn it into like the Freemasons and stuff like that, which is still around, and how that definitely plays a kind of a central plot to the realistic kind of part of the movie. But yeah, so it's interesting that like this is sort of a weird gripe about the movie, but the fact that Christopher Plummer's like, and the only secret we have is the words, "The secret lies with Charlotte," and we've done nothing for hundreds of years. We've kept on to that.
That's what, yeah.
Charlotte, North Carolina? Maybe.
Well, his dad is like, and that clue will lead to another clue, will lead to another clue. And I'm like, look, you haven't found a clue since your great granddad. So
the real lame treasure is just like season tickets to the Hornets.
Is this it?
Oh, man.
But yeah, so it's like, and then that becomes like a riddle, and then they go to the Declaration of Independence, which has the numbers on the back, and that takes them to Philadelphia. Philadelphia takes them to the like Oculus glasses, and then that takes them to Trinity Church, which takes them to like, wrap it out in my head.
Yeah.
And then takes them to like the...
The catacomb or the sinkhole?
Yeah.
It's like a mile deep.
Bit, that scene
six
both...
one way, half dozen.
Hey, Jerry! Hey, look at this!
On one hand,
scene,
I love it.
I know, it stresses me out, but it also just annoys me so much how it's like one person lightly steps on a board and it like shatters and they fall. And then five people jump on this old elevator and it's like, all right, we're good.
Yeah, it turns into like the Darth Maul death for a little bit. He falls down a giant pit.
He'll come back in the spinoff.
But yeah. But no, I mean, the thing that everyone remembers from the movie, at least when I was a kid, I think, was the whole heist of the Declaration of Independence is sort of the central part. But honestly, like you were saying, Elijah, when we were like, is that I think the whole chasing through Philly is maybe better.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It's
like,
so great.
Yeah. It's so cool.
And especially because it's like structure-wise. you know, it starts with Ben Gates and some guy chasing him, and they like go up this like ladder or whatever, this kind of thing, and then they're on the rooftops. Meanwhile, Abigail and
Riley
yeah, yeah. are like running through the streets, and they're being chased, and they go into the market where she hides behind the counter.
Who, Baldy?
Stay here as long as you like.
Yeah.
But it's just real. It's engaging and it's fun. You're watching two different chases happen, and it's all in Philadelphia.
Right. Yeah. And it does the thing. Were you gonna say something?
I was, but finish your thought.
Yeah, but the thing where it's like all good chase scenes, there's like always are like an avalanche. It just keeps building and building and building. Mm-hmm. So like for Ben Gates, it starts in like the graveyard, and then it's like a shootout. But then yeah, like you say, it runs on the street, up a fire pole, like on the rooftops, and yeah, so like it keeps gradually building.
Yeah,
which is what I love so much about it. And you can say the same that happens with the Declaration of Independence, where it's sort of a stealth kind of thing, but then it turns into like running, and then they get in the cars, it turns into a car chase. So that's really cool.
Which that was actually Diane Kruger on the car,
right? She did her own stunts
on the van door.
She was doing her own stunts.
For holy cow!
I know. Yeah,
I was wondering because I was watching that door swing open. I was like, that's kind of sketchy. Like, is her like hanging on?
Oh yeah. But it was, I mean, I'm sure, like, I don't know whether it was done, like, what kind of set they used, but she was probably, like, all harnessed into everything. But, yeah.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
She's like, no, I've got good grip strength. I can do this.
Tom Cruise out there. Like, yeah, I'll hold on to this plane.
I love the whole heist scene. I think it's awesome. Yeah. I love the fact that Ben Gates is breaking in and Ian is breaking in at the same time.
Yes.
And you're like, watch who's going to get to it first.
Yeah. Right. And then it also mirrors how the last time they saw each other inside the Charlotte ship, where it's like the both of them are on the opposite sides of the doors and they leave. But then they come. And then when they're in the National Archives, like they enter from like almost a same type of hallway.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that was going to be my point, is that you have Nick Cage and you have Sean Bean, and they're both like pursuing the same goal. And obviously Nick Cage is more elegant in how he goes about it with the history knowledge and with like some of the subtle things. And then Sean Bean is like still intelligent, but a little bit more of a like, brute force tactic every step of the way. But they're keeping step and they're getting to the same place.
I was actually really excited watching that scene because it's so great. You see, you know, like you said, Nick Cage using his intelligence and like social engineering of he takes pictures of their ID cards and he gets one made and they're going in like without damaging as little as possible and sneaking in, and then cut to Sean Bean and his goons and they're loading up guns and packing C4 and it's such a great contrast.
A very funny moment that made me laugh very hard is while Ben and Riley are going through like their heist, it cuts to just a wide shot of the Watergate Hotel, and then it's like Sean Bean and everybody inside there. It's like, oh, I see what you're saying.
Okay. Think anyone's listening to this?
When they see each other across the hallway and he's just carrying the decoration, it's so funny.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, all of that is super sick. In a weird way, okay, I mean, spoilers for National Treasure if you haven't seen it, which is like a weird time to be saying it now, but in a weird way, it has like this, I guess you could call it like a socialist ending, where the whole idea is like, that's too good for one man, so we're just going to give it all back because it's not ours to begin with.
Yeah.
And so, but we're all just going to keep at least 1%.
That's always what I think of whenever there's something about a quest for a great treasure.
Yeah.
And unlike in like Holes, where they find this chest and they're all just like, okay, sweet, we have all this money now. When you have something like you find a literal, we'll use the second movie, like you find a city of golds and all of this stuff. And even in the first one, that huge room of all this, what do you do?
Right.
Like, who do you call? Like, hey, so I just found like a butt ton of gold and stuff, and I can't carry it out. Right. But like,
is this Wells Fargo? And,
yeah. Well, can I got a wagon down.
Next up on Pawn Stars.
Finally, that I can use that cash for gold.
I've got this.
That's what I want to see. Is
I've got these scrolls from the Library of Alexandria.
What's that show?
Are you sure?
Best I can do is $20.
What's a Storage Wars? When they like storage open wars. Up like expired storage crates or whatever, or they like start bidding on it, but they like cut it open and it's like ancient Mesopotamic gold.
Yeah, instead they just take them like, down there. 200. All right, get on this elevator. I'll show you. It's down here. Trust me.
Yeah,
but it's interesting because, okay, so if the entire treasure is valued over $10 billion and they all get 1%, don't worry, I did the math, That's $100 million each.
Yeah,
for the three of them. So you're still doing fine.
Oh, well, that's the comedy.
Wait, did you say 100 billion?
It's a $10 billion. $10 billion. So 1% of that is $100 million.
$100 million. Yeah.
And that's the comedy where Riley's like, ugh, just 1% drives 1%. Off in his Ferrari.
Right.
Yeah. Oh, half kills of 1%. Me. I couldn't spend half of 1%. I couldn't spend $100 million in my life, I don't think.
I wouldn't even know what to do.
I could.
It's a lot of chalupas.
I'll say this. Like, I could if I spent it with the purpose of excess. Like, sure. Okay, yeah, I'll buy, 20 islands and a fleet of Ferraris. But, like, just living life, even if I wanted for nothing, which if I had $100 million, I'm pretty sure I would want for nothing. Even if I just bought things that I thought looked cool, still I would maybe blow through a couple mil.
Yeah, that's 25 million 4-for-4 combos from Wendy's. Can you imagine?
You're doing some fast math over here.
Look at that. That's it. I know what I'm doing.
We're at 50 million Old Chicago after 10, $2.
Now the real question is, eating only the 4-for-4, how long can you live on $100 million?
Are you saying it's like a popular, like, I've had 40 pizzas in the last 30 days? Oh, God. The day of reckoning is coming.
And you know what? He was right. This is probably a joke that's super irrelevant by now, the whole Papa John's reckoning thing, but he was right.
I was going to say, I really like... I was surprised at this movie. Of course, this movie came in 2004. We talked about in our Coraline episode, like, 2009, 2010 was, like, the boom of, like, everything had a 3D release. Mm. But this had, I mean, like, Spy Kids 3D comes out, like, around the same time.
Yeah, it did.
And so we have, like, sort of thing. But I'm surprised that there wasn't, like, a 3D release of Natural Treasure where everyone got, like, the ocular glasses.
Oh, that would be cool.
Blue and red.
And it would say, like, because it would say at the bottom of, like, Spy Kids 3D, like, put your glasses on now. Take your glasses off now.
Yeah.
But instead, if you had, like, the four different colors that Ben Franklin had on his, so it would be, like, switch to green and red now, and then, like, the whole time you have to, like, fiddle with
the
thing.
A lot of frustrated kids in the
like, what do I do now?
Mom!
That's a weird one. We should definitely do this. But in the movie Rugrats Go Wild, there was Burger King had a thing going on with them, which is they had, like, a scratch and sniff card that they gave out at Burger King. That you could watch the movie and, like, at certain times a number would appear and you would scratch that number and a smell would happen with your card.
Yeah.
See, I'm just getting flashbacks from It's Tough to Be a Bug.
It's Tough to Be a Bug. Animal Kingdom. They don't have a lot of... You don't scratch anything. Yeah. But yeah.
No, but it's the same concept.
It's Tough to Be a Bug. It's the scariest thing I've
ever It's the scariest.
I have no idea what that is.
So, brief synopsis. Jonathan and I saw the movie Us at a movie theater, and we were talking about some of the scariest things we've ever done. Jonathan mentions this 3D movie at Disney World.
Yeah, well, it's a 4D experience.
Oh, yeah.
And so, there's a 3D movie that you're watching, but it's also
like the chair movies.
Yeah, there's stuff in there. The animatronics fall from the ceiling.
Yeah,
and
there's
like
giant spiders that jump in. Yeah, so because you're the size of a
bug. At the very end, the grasshopper from Bug's Life comes out of the floor, like in front of the stage, like with smoke rising and like starts
like
moving
Prince.
As an animatronic, like threatening the entire audience.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
I had a similar experience, but not with animatronics, of when my sister Emily and I went to see Cats in Raleigh.
Because spiders came from the ceiling.
Cats. The name of Cats has been disparaged by the whatever that movie was that came out this year. But the musical has a lot of great and fun music, and it was my sister Emily and I's one of our favorite musicals growing up. And during intermission, we're just sitting there talking, and I'm on like the leftmost seat in the aisle, and I'm looking to my right, talking to her. And she just kind of looks over my shoulder and she's like, turn around. And I'm like, what? And Rum Tum Tugger is right next to my face. And a bunch of the cats had been suspended from the ceiling into the aisles.
Oh,
and they're just kind of like doing their dance through the aisles. And it was, I almost peed myself.
Wow.
Rum Tum Tugger right there. It was something.
Wow. Yeah. I've been saying because everyone hates the movie Cats.
Yes.
That Universal, who runs Halloween Horror Nights, needs to do like a Cats themed horror maze.
Oh,
for,
yeah,
like, Halloween.
And it's literally just the movie. Like that's what the horror is. You just watch the movie and it's terrifying.
Oh my. So going back to National Treasure.
I'm sorry, scratch and sniff.
But yeah, so yeah, again, we started like Jerry Bruckheimer being this, like, probably one of the biggest producers of the 2000s and during this time, is that they want to shoot as much as they can on location, which they even did with Pirates of the Caribbean, where they shot in the Caribbean and they shot on, you know, in the Bahamas. They shot all over the place. The Pirates of the Caribbean finished shooting March of 2003 and came out in June of 2003. And this movie started production in like September of 2003. Mm. And so it was like a quick turnaround. Even the behind the scenes, there's even people being like, well, this is a lot different than Pirates. Like, so it's a lot of the same crew, a lot of the same people. Even at times, some of the score sounds very similar. I'm like, that sounds like a Pirates like reference.
I felt that too. And I'm pretty sure I actually meant to look this up. Do you know the show The Mentalist?
I know a little bit. Yeah.
It's a great, great show on CBS from, I don't know, mid 2000s. During the second movie, I think it's like the opening song or whatever, I could have sworn was the main theme or whatever throughout The Mentalist. And I was like, are they just using the same music or is this like somehow similar? But all of them had so many similar vibes to other things.
Right. I think it might just have been part of the era, or it might just be,
that's true.
Part of the theme.
It was the Disney mid-2000s yes. action movie
Boom.
Score.
But yeah, so they actually filmed in the Library of Congress. They shut down Pennsylvania Avenue to get, like, to use some shots, and they shot in Trinity Church in New York. You know, they used a little bit of Dell. They went to the Franklin Institute, the Lincoln Memorial. Interesting thing about the Lincoln Memorial is when they're shooting it on the steps, the water... It had to be digitally put in.
The water was, it was fake.
Yeah. Which the same thing happened with Forrest Gump. Because there was no, was there not a river there when they shot it? Or
I think it was just, because it was like closed for maintenance or whatever. So they shut off the water. But I still am not sure how they did that with Forrest Gump because, Jenny runs through the water to get to Forrest. I'm like, how did they fake? Is that like they put her in a separate pool and just CGI'd it onto?
I don't know.
But, I mean, hey, it looked like
water to me. Let's ask Robin Wright herself. Robin Wright, ladies and gentlemen. Right behind you.
That was
you.
An excited scream, actually, not a scared scream. I love Robin Wright.
To be, it's interesting because she told me that she was in that production of Cats. So maybe she was...
The Rum Tum Tugger.
Behind you. Hey, I was in The Princess Bride. You seen House of Cards yet? Yeah.
Like, whoa.
So yeah, of course. So we were saying, and for the Charlotte, they shot that in Utah instead of the Arctic,
which close enough.
Close enough, you did it. There's snow, right? The interior was a set that was actually filmed inside of a giant fridge or something. Mm. So they were actually cold. And then for the National Archives, like that, the interior is a set. The exterior is the actual National Archives place. But you were saying with Independence Hall, which. Some speculation on that because the behind the scenes says that they filmed at least the exteriors we know of and like the rooftop parts of Independence Hall. Now, apparently there's an internet going around saying that they actually filmed the inside of it at Knott's Berry Farm in Buena Park, California, a theme park. I told you guys this is a theme park podcast in disguise. We keep bringing it up.
That's right. It keeps
coming because out. In Knott's Berry Farm, they have like a recreation of Independence Hall. That's part of an attraction there. And people had been saying, and it's been said everywhere, including Knott's Berry Farm, who has tweeted and claimed that they have filmed the movie inside their recreation of the Independence Hall. So the behind the scenes says differently, but Knott's Berry Farm is all saying otherwise. Oh. So who has the answer? Well, email us at mostextremepodcast@gmail.com use the hashtag Knott's Berry Hall. I don't know.
I tend to believe that. Knott's Berry Hall is going to be super stoked. Like, we're trending on Twitter?
What?
Well, I tend to want to believe the behind the scenes just because, I mean, it's a Disney movie and Disney would never lie or cheat or do anything wrong.
Exactly. So I'm not sure. If anyone who's worked on the film wants to call in,
come forward.
Yeah, call in. Our number is 919-125.
Are you about to give up your
No.
Oh, crap. should we talk about some of the acting a little bit?
Yes, we should.
Okay. How do you guys feel? This is my first Nick Cage movie. What about you guys?
Hold on. What? Oh, Back in the day.
Back in the day. Okay. No, not like today.
Gotcha. Yeah, I was about like, to say. Are you kidding me?
This guy, Nick Cage.
No, but probably. I probably saw this around the same time as Con Air, which are two very drastically different movies to have seen.
And it's also a weird point in his career anyway with National Treasure, because he already won the Oscar in 95, and then right after that makes The Rock, Face Off, Con Air, like all in a row. So he's already become like a big enough name.
Yeah.
But then now, yeah, he's...
He's in a kid's movie.
Yeah, he's in a kid's movie, and definitely... He's taming it down a little bit in the performance. Yeah.
This is tame Cage. This is probably his most mild-mannered performance. Not to say it's bad. He's great. He just doesn't have a lot of the, like, Nicolas Cage-isms as we would expect from him.
Yes. Yeah. Either of you guys have any thoughts?
Yeah. This, it might have been my first experience, but probably I can't discern between when I would have seen this or Gone in 60 Seconds or Con Air.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or like, some of those other ones. I haven't seen the one he won an Oscar for. I mean, that's...
Leaving Las Vegas?
Yeah, yeah. I haven't seen that. I've seen,
You seen Moonstruck?
I was just about to mention Moonstruck, because my mom was just talking... My mom and my sister love him, and is it Cher?
Yeah, Cher's in it, yeah.
And they love him in that, and I was like, you think Nicolas Cage was cute? And they're like, watch this movie, and like, he was a hunk. He was a hunk back in his 20s.
He was supposed to be Superman, right?
He was
going to
be Superman.
He was going
to
be.
Have you seen any Nick Cage? I mean, this
is my only Nick Cage movie, pretty sure.
Have you seen Into the Spider-Verse? He's in that.
That's true.
Oh, that's true. That's very true. Yes. I've seen two Nick Cage movies.
We just need to make this a Nick Cage podcast so we can get you to watch every Nick Cage movie.
I think for a lot of kids, at least in our generation, this was their first Nick Cage movie. And so a lot of their, like, the memes and, like, the whole, you know, societal, like, joke around it came probably first from this, for understanding him as an actor. Because, I mean, the best line reading of all time is, "I'm going to steal it. I'm going to steal the Declaration of Independence." And he, like, turns
Doesn't
and
he say
walks
that,
away.
Like,
it's like, oh,
in front of it? Like, next to the security guard?
Okay, so this is what I brought up to my roommate as soon as I finished this movie. It's like, yeah, that's the quote. That's one of the best movie quotes of all time, is, "I'm going to steal the Declaration of Independence."
Yeah.
They say, in some form, the phrase, "steal the Declaration of Independence," about 25 times in this movie. "We have to steal the Declaration of Independence. I'm not going to let you steal the Declaration of Independence. I'm going to steal the Declaration. You didn't just steal the Declaration." Just so many times. I'm like, look, you can just say, like, the document at that point, or it. "I'm going to steal it." You're not going to steal it.
DOI.
"I'm going to steal the DOI." Like, the what? Declaration of Independence. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the Honest trailer that just came out related him to Adam West's Batman, which I think is pretty accurate and sort of like how he's like
solving through puzzles.
Yeah, he's like solving the riddle. Like, let's see.
Within Charlotte Motor Speedway. No, Charlotte.
Charlotte, I know a girl named Charlotte.
I like. I should
What's
call
she
her.
Up to?
I like. I think it was in the second one. Again, I watched them back to back last night, so they're both kind of mixed up. But he's doing that thing where he's working through, and he's like, I think it's when he's talking about the two twin desks. He's like, "The two twins in Shanghai, the two twin." And Riley starts like nodding his head, and he's like, "No, that's ridiculous." And Riley starts shaking his head.
Yeah. No, we will
the
do
poison.
A second. We'll do a National
Treasure. Poison for Cusco.
Cusco's poison.
We'll definitely do a National Treasure 2 episode because I think his acting gets crazy.
Oh, gosh, it's so good.
Which is interesting because in this movie, he's trying to like, because he's like, "All my family has is the Gates name to find this treasure," which is just funny because Nick Cage is already an eccentric man himself. Like, his, like, if you read his Wikipedia, you'll be like, oh my goodness.
Yeah, he's
Jonathan, you show me a video. They were, like, people talking about, like, he has, like, crazy amounts of wealth.
There was a video by, Jesse Cox, who does, like, gaming and streaming, but he has a side project where he just, like, talks about random whatever, and they were going over an article listing, like, how, like, Nick Cage, like, spent hit all of the money that he earned, and like I want to say maybe he went bankrupt, but it was literally like
he
bought an octopus,
like, Ghost Rider and stuff.
Yeah,
bought a great white shark, two leopards.
Didn't you get like a T-Rex skull?
$3 million worth of fossils.
Yeah.
Wow.
Dinosaur bones.
It was literally like the most like, why would you ever like buy that for your, it was as if like, it was like, all right, let's see.
No, yeah.
Shopping list, you know, mac and cheese, the Rosetta Stone.
That's what I would have to do if I'm trying to spend $100 million. It's like, what's just the dumbest thing?
Yeah, you're I'll just buy like,
what's the moon?
What's that? This Nebraska cost?
You know that video of they're like, it's on the street, they're interviewing this guy, like, what would you do if you won the lottery? And he's like, I think I would buy an island.
Oh, yeah.
And it would be my island.
I did hear, you know, Johnny Depp owns an island.
Does he really?
Yeah. Do you know what it's called?
What is it called?
Johnny Depp's Island.
That's great. Like Google Earth, Johnny.
Elijah Moore's Island.
Doesn't have as nice a ring to
it. It's Australia.
So long, Great Britain.
Well, Dave, I just came into $100 million. I thought I'd create Middle Dakota.
Diane Kruger is in this movie. This is one of her first movies. I mean, before this, she did Troy, I think. That's all I had seen her before this. Of course, she hadn't done, like, Inglourious Bastards or anything yet. But it's interesting how they put her German heritage into the movie.
I love that.
Yeah. Me too. I think it's a little interesting. So when I was a kid, at one point when he gives the extra, is it the button, right?
Yeah,
the campaign button.
Yeah. Her like assistant's like, this just came for you. And she's like, I hope it's not from Stan. And this whole time I was like, who's Stan? We never learn who Stan is. And then I figured out that Stan is the coworker that hits on her.
Yes. The guy that like checks her out while she's typing her password in.
Yeah. And then hands her another champagne.
Yes.
That's Stan.
What's that actor's name?
Michael Cera. No, I
don't. I mean, yeah. I mean, if you wanted the button, yeah.
Whatever. Hey, here's the button.
George Michael hands him the button.
I'm gonna steal the Declaration of Independence.
I'm looking up Stan's name right now. Was it Stan, or did you just like make that up because you couldn't remember his name? No, it is Stan. Don McManus.
That's
the actor's name.
He's one of those like, oh yeah, that guy. He's a billion things.
Exactly. Yeah. Always has a small role in everything. I had that same thought where I was like, oh yeah, I think he's from like The Fugitive. I don't know.
Speaking of people who are in everything, Sean Bean.
Yes. Doesn't die. Spoiler alert. Yeah. But he doesn't die in this movie.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'd probably seen The Fellowship of the Ring before this, but I definitely hadn't seen like GoldenEye. Or I'm trying to think, of like he's always, you know, of course, the bad guy normally. Yeah. Or of course, I mean, Game of Thrones hadn't come out yet, but he's good and he's great in this movie. Of course, it's not that hard of a part to play.
Equilibrium also.
One of the funny things I found is that it's funny because it's themed very much around like Revolutionary War themes, and all the bad guys are British.
Yeah, they're all European. And it's so like it's the European against Americans. I had that same thought where I was like, this seems a little, is that why they chose to ask Diane Kruger to like use her natural accent and to be a German character?
Because
it's like, we don't want all just Americans versus Europeans. Let's throw a German in there.
I do. Well, with Diane Kruger's character, it is sort of sad that like the minute they see her, they're like, she's cute, like loudly.
Oh, yeah.
And then,
very cute man.
Yeah. And then, like you were saying, basically, they basically, like, lie to her, kidnap her, and then she agrees to help them out, and then for some reason just falls in love with Ben Gates. And that's one of my qualms with the movie, is just like, I do not buy the romance at all.
Well, as we know from the second one, it doesn't really last very long.
It doesn't, except, and then it does again at the end, which, again, I would buy.
After two adventures, you gotta just go ahead and shack up with the person.
I bought their relationship in the second one of, like, you know, they started out and then something didn't happen. And it was like a very understandable thing of like, you always think you're right about everything, which totally fits with Ben Gates's character.
Right.
Like he's always kind of right. And then, you know, they have that. I buy that. But yeah, the start of their relationship, I never.
Yeah.
It was just
like
kind of a
flirting
romance
with each other with the smallest fitting room doors I've ever seen at Urban Outfitters. And then
which gets to the only part of this movie that I think is bad.
Is that scene?
No, not that scene. The only part of this movie that I think is bad. I've heard your. I think Nick Cage is perfect.
He's good in the movie.
I think everybody is
good.
Hold up. I think everybody and everything in this movie is so much fun and beautifully put together. The only thing that I hate is when they've rubbed the lemon on the back of the Declaration and they say, we need heat. And they slow motion breathing onto it, which is supposed to be the like, oh yeah, and they're getting together.
Yeah, their faces are so nice.
That is the only part of the movie I hate.
It's stupid.
What a so minor thing to hate for that to be your only thing.
Which just means it's very close to a flawless movie.
I'm just going to play the contrarian because I've known a few history majors.
That's how they met?
And if...
breathing on documents.
Listen, there's no quicker way to get to a history major's heart than to say, like, I would let you fall down this chasm to save the Declaration of Independence.
Okay, actually, yeah.
Ooh, swiping right on that.
I would have done the same. You would? It's like, I would have thrown both of you down.
Yeah.
Right before that, though, was my... But then he made in the honest trailers for it was when they're standing on top of the chasm, and one of Sean Bean's guys goes, they made all of this... How did... people make all of this with hand tools. Mm-hmm. Someone else says the same way they made the pyramids or the Great Wall of China. And my first thought was slavery. Like that's where I thought they were going with this. Like, no, that's how basically if there's anything older than, I don't know, 150 years, probably much less actually in the United States, it was built by slaves.
Exactly.
But instead, they just didn't. It was like the same way they did that. And they were like, oh, okay, yeah, they worked really hard. Like, no.
I think Justin Bartha says, like, yeah, the aliens. The aliens. What do you think about him as Riley?
Love it. So funny.
Yeah. So funny. Test audiences, the original cut of the movie, the 4-hour cut of the movie or whatever, they liked him so much that they had to, like, get more reshoots of him being funny or just, like, found as much footage of him just, like, being funny so they could put in the movie because it worked so well.
Yeah. I mean, can you imagine how dry this movie would be with just the two historians? Just like, I found a George Washington campaign. Oh, tell me more.
It was weird, nerdy, flirty. Yeah. It's funny, but it also has like that. I'll say like 90s/2000s, cheesy kind of misogyny of where like he's just all about the pretty ladies and like that's such a thing for him, which is like, I mean, that's just how that goofy sidekick character was written,
right?
Then.
Like, she's cute. Is that the hot girl?
Yeah.
Another excellent film that Justin Bartha is in, Failure to Launch. Another good Matthew McConaughey.
Yeah.
Have y'all done
so if you like National Treasure, check out Failure to Launch. Wonderful.
What year did that come out?
It was within a couple years.
There's a famous story that Justin Bartha has said before. That before they had to do reshoots, him and his friends all shaved their heads. And so being an amateur actor at this point, not realizing, oh, shoot. So like the last scene with him in the Ferrari, he's got a wig on. And he said before, he's like, the whole time I was just worried that wig was about to fly off. And then, and like a lot of the stuff of them after being chased in Phillies with a wig. So things like that.
Hmm.
I personally feel like half of his jokes work and half of them don't.
Yeah.
That's just me personally. But I think a lot of it's when it's like, we're just putting a joke in here so that there's a joke. Or is it him like reacting? So when he says something like, do you know what the preservation room is? And he's like, delicious jams and jellies. That one works for me.
I love it.
But if it's like, there's pizza over there, and then he's just like him eating pizza the whole time. It's like, no, let's get back to the plot. But that's just me. It works fine.
He was a good, like you said, kind of tension breaker of, imagine if he wasn't there.
Yeah.
Right.
I think of him every time I see a meme about like, hackers in 2000s movies.
Oh, I'm in.
Like that's exactly who I think
shooting
of.
Shooting the laser.
Yeah.
At the frog thermometer.
Having like sending the wire up that like
cable
thing.
Yeah, you just pinch a wire with another wire and suddenly you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did, but that was another just, I don't, it's not realistic, but I love during that scene when he has control of the cameras and then the bad guys come and just like cut through everything and take it over from him. I was like, okay, that's kind
of
cool.
There's like the moving like shot in the van of him being like, I hate that guy. It's like, oh, we're in, baby. I love this. Yeah. How do they think the only time we know their backstory of how they found Raleigh is like on their way to the Charlotte, Nick Cage says something like, oh, you want us to put us back in that windowless cubicle? We found you. And that's it. And we're like, all right.
Yeah.
I guess we'll buy it.
That's true. I never questioned why he knew him. And then at the, like, one of the very first scenes in the second one, after Riley's book doesn't do well, and he just walks to I guess his house or whatever, and Ben Gates is sitting out front, and they're just like, anyways, what's going on with you? And it's like, oh, so you guys are just chilling, or has it been 2 years, however long since the first one?
Right. But I feel like my MVP of this movie is Harvey Keitel. Harvey Keitel in this movie kills
it. Dude, and that was another one that completely went over my head as a kid.
Didn't see any of his movies ahead of time. Not watching Reservoir Dogs when I'm seven. But yeah, no, I think he kills it. I want a whole Disney Plus show based on his character. Let's make it. It's going to be great.
And he's also part of, like, I feel bad for bringing up the second one so much, but how he gets involved in the second one is so ludicrous.
Oh, really?
Like, clearly they were just like, we want Harvey Keitel in this movie again, so let's just have him get involved. But no, he's fantastic in this.
Okay. Awesome. Yeah, I agree. But yeah.
Really, though, if we're talking about MVP, I feel like really we're talking about SMVP, the second most valuable player, because are you really putting Harvey Keitel above Nicolas Cage?
I think as in like the most like interesting character, but probably Nick Cage is the best part of the movie. Yeah. But as in terms of like, that's my favorite performance.
Yeah.
Is the best? No, but.
Okay. Fair enough.
Yeah. But another thing I thought, this movie's way funnier than I remember it being when I was watching it. Cause like my favorite, the part that made me laugh the most is when he jumps off the aircraft carrier into the Hudson and they go, Agent Dawes, you got a visual? Sir, it's the Hudson. There's nothing as visible. I was like, boom, that's good. Or even when Abigail and Ben kiss for the first time and they walk the and the henchman behind him's like, why doesn't this ever happen to me?
That's okay. Three, my lord. Yes.
You think he's trying to eat? Maybe he wants to kiss Nick Cage. I don't
that's
know.
That's true, yeah.
That's what I thought he was thinking. It's like, he wants to kiss him? All right.
Who doesn't?
And then the stuff like, okay, this is a Riley joke that I like where they're in the treasure room for the first time. And then Abigail's like, wow, look at this. And
they're like, wow, look from the library.
Yeah. And then Riley's like, it's a tall, greenish blue man.
And he like hugs it, right?
Yeah. He's like,
he says, he doesn't know what it means. Says something right after that, like, it's a tall, greenish, bluish man.
With a weird goatee.
With a weird goatee.
That must be important.
But yeah.
Yeah. I almost feel like maybe the shot of him hugging it was ad-libbed or something.
Maybe. They were like, I feel, you know what we need?
I could see him, like, trying not to smile, like, while doing that.
But yeah, so the whole time I kept watching this, I'm like, I kept thinking, like, man, they don't make movies like this anymore.
No.
And it makes me sad, but it makes me glad that we even have it. But, yeah. Like, yeah, blowing up the Charlotte, like, huge explosions. Or the fact that Disney's making a movie that's, you can call it adult, but really, it's for everybody,
and,
you know?
And that's right. Something that stuck out to me as well, is I was like, this is actually kind of refreshing. There's no teenagers. There's no 20-somethings getting in way over their heads where they have that conversation. They get, you know, falsely accused by the government of something, and the government agent's like, just stay out of this, kid. Go back to... It's like, no, none of that. These are all grown adults, and they're going on an adventure. And there was... Yeah, something refreshing about that.
Yeah, and even, like, okay, like, take current day Disney, like, Walt Disney live action and compare it to 2004. It's, like, a completely different company.
Yeah.
You know? It's, like, because it feels like this is when they were taking risks, mm-hmm. and they're looking to what can we make that's still family-oriented, but what can we do? Compared to now, it feels like everything is so, like, based on, like, we have an algorithm on, like, this is going to hit this target audience. I mean, I've been watching a lot of The Boys, so that's probably why I'm getting that. But it's, like, very much based on, like, everything so corporately decided. We didn't have to go through so many different red tapes to get there. But I like that about it. And I would probably say that, like, this era of live-action Disney movies is, like, maybe their peak. They hit it because you have holes... You've got Miracle, you've got, like, Remember the Titans, Miracle's you've so got good. All these movies, the all
friggin'
coming up.
Pirates, the start of Pirates. Yeah.
So, yeah, do you have...
I was just gonna... And it was an original idea.
Yeah.
Right,
it was
too.
Just, hey, let's come up with a fun thing and do it.
Yeah, and it's... I always not, like, appreciate... Like, 40 years ago. Like, historical fiction, mm-hmm. where it's like, this is based... Again, we're in Philadelphia, and we're in D.C., and we're in these... actual historical places, talking about documents, talking about the do-good letters, all of these things. But there's also this completely fabricated, made-up thing beside it. And so it is not a history lesson, not one that you should take a test on, but it's, you know, it's kind of grounded in some form of reality, which is refreshing. And yeah. even the, like, not supernatural, but the super fictional of it, of, you know, the Masons and the gold and the conspiracies and all of that, is still not so outlandish as to not be relatively believable.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Which the second one kind of loses. They're just like, let's go way over the top. Right. But this one, it's still very grounded.
Right.
Until you get to the chasm. I have issues with the chasm and the staircase, yeah, but
turns into we, like, gotta get some action.
Yeah.
But yeah. So it's interesting this movie came out in November of 2004. Do you have that?
I have this pulled up. So this is a list of its movies that were also released in November 2004. That's what we're looking at.
Yeah, the domestic box office.
Yeah, so National Treasure, from movies that were released that month and that year, second highest box office total.
Wow.
Of those movies, behind only, can anybody take a guess?
2004, oh gosh.
I have in front of me.
Return of the King? Was that?
Close.
I have it in front of me. Well.
Then you're the only one guessing. when I say close, you're not. It's The Incredibles.
Oh, wow.
Was the only movie that outperformed.
Yeah, how was that me. Close to Return of the King?
I could tell your heart was in it. I liked your Incredibles. Effort.
Gosh.
I remember that being in theaters till like February. Like, that was for a long time. Because normally movies have like a 3-month period. That had at least a 5.
Talk about, like, you know, I said earlier that I don't know if I would consider National Treasure a classic. That's because classics, I think, at least have to have like a 50-year-old shelf life to be considered classic. Mm-hmm. And we're still, what, only 16 years past
we'll
that.
Find out.
That being said,
we'll be the ones to
National
find
Treasure
out.
And The Incredibles especially hold their mark in history as so great.
Scientists say that the people who are going to be able to deem National Treasure as a classic have already been born. So that might be us.
What were the other movies that came out that time?
I got Polar Express on that list.
Oh, wow.
That was the other one.
That's
the SpongeBob SquarePants movie.
That was it.
That's a great one.
They came. Okay, so that's the thing I'm seeing.
They came out in all four of those movies came out in 2004?
Yeah, November of 2004. Yeah. SpongeBob SquarePants movie and National Treasure came out the same day. Can you believe that? That seems like they would have been way farther apart.
That's Nickelodeon and Disney, like, fighting each other.
Right.
For the box office.
And they were both pretty close in terms of at least the opening weekend.
Obviously I'm wrong, but I pictured Polar Express coming out so much later than that.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
Like that's what years, like 2010, if I had to guess. Like, which, I don't know, I just put that as such a different, and maybe it was just because I didn't see Polar Express for the first time for, like, 4 years after it came out.
Right, yeah.
But, wow, that's wild.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, so, sort of to close off, it has been announced that they are making a National Treasure 3, with the screenwriters from Bad Boys for Life, which is kind of strange that they're also making a fourth Bad Boys movie, and they didn't call that one Bad Boys 3, so they could call the fourth one Bad Boys for Life.
Yeah.
But, you know, bad decision. So anyway, National Treasure 3 is being made currently, or working in, you know, very, very slow development right now. But I thought it'd be interesting if we could maybe go around and share some of our ideas for what a National Treasure 3 could be. I actually wrote a pitch.
Yeah, you guys, like, especially Jarrett, you...
I have 2 pages.
Yeah, you got super excited when you started mentioning this.
I'm kind of nervous. I will let you go last.
I have one log line, and that's it.
Go for it. You want to go first?
Oh, no, okay. I don't. But...
Okay, Jonathan?
I can go first, because I've probably got the weakest one.
Okay, what's your idea for National Treasure 3?
So, I've got an idea of where we're going to take the franchise in general. I scrapped my original... treatment for National Treasure 3,
okay,
because it was about Benjamin Gates running for president, and I felt like that was hitting a little too close to home for comfort. So instead, I'm thinking we're gonna go in the direction of, you guys ever seen not a very well known movie, that movie Sahara?
Yeah.
Where, like, it starts off, like, and it's like, oh, we're going to find this, like, ironclad from the Civil War. And they end up in the Sahara Desert, like, trying to stop bioweapons. So we're going to keep doing stuff like that to the point where you know, obviously Ian's going to get out of prison and cause troubles again. And, you know, Nick Cage is going to have to steal the space shuttle to stop him. And it's going to be, they're going to be in space. They're going to be like, I can't let you steal the Voyager space probe, Ian. Can't stop me, Gates.
And so it's kind of like Gravity.
Still Ed Harris.
They're like floating around.
I can't let you.
I love it.
I have a feeling that's we're all going to go down the same vein with our with our National Treasure 3 pitches.
You care to hit me with your best shot?
Yeah, I can't so wait to hear I have two. With. Because okay. My main thing was, like we said earlier, quote of the century, I'm going to steal the Declaration of Independence.
Right. What can you beat
and
that with?
And so they made two.
Right.
What did they say in the trailer to get you to see that movie? I'm going to kidnap the President of the United States.
Yeah.
Where there is a clear escalation here. And so I have two. Because again, both mm-hmm. with the scale of what heist they pull off getting bigger.
Right.
Just the first one was a couple of guys looking for some treasure in, you know, the greater Philadelphia area. It was Philadelphia, D.C., and New York.
Right.
And then the second movie there in Philly and D.C. and France and England and going everywhere.
Right.
So I had two things. One also involves space. They go into space. They discover that like ancient Mayan temples were built by aliens, and those aliens are living on the dark side of the moon.
Oh,
big yes. thing is, I'm going to destroy the moon. That's the big line from that.
I love it.
Other one, also somehow involving aliens, probably. I don't know. This I literally just made this up like an hour ago when you texted me saying we were doing the third movie ideas. They're going through this conspiracy and the Ben or the Gates family lineage, and they find something sus about the JFK assassination. Someone was involved in the JFK assassination, but they're like, wait, that doesn't make sense. He wasn't born yet. I have to go back in time and stop the Kennedy assassination.
What?
There you go. Oh, my gosh.
So those are my two pitches. Either destroy moon aliens or prevent the Kennedy assassination.
Whoa, it's like a time travel.
That's,
yes.
That's incredible.
We live in a twilight world. Yeah. Okay, do you want me to
take
go?
Take that, Jerry Bruckheimer. Do something with that.
Go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, okay. So we've stolen the Declaration of Independence and we've kidnapped the President of the United States. So, and National Treasure 2 came out in 2007 and now it's 2020. It's almost 2021.
Is this the pep talk from Despicable Me?
No. No. So we have to make a movie that's more up to date with the times and something a little more relevant for the American audience. Sure. So here's my pitch for National Treasure 3. Abigail Chase, of course. She's doing some of her work curating old documents, working at the National Archives, and she stumbles upon a small journal by Theodore Roosevelt that's documenting many of his adventures through the western United States and the national parks. And the journal tells of some secret connection between all the different national parks and that they could be in some type of danger in the future. She's not sure what it could mean. So she gets her on and off boyfriend, Ben Gates, to help investigate.
Hold on. So is Diane Kruger the lead in this one?
No.
Oh, okay.
Still,
sorry, you were just you
but
were
she plays it. A big role,
sure, right?
So she gets help, and so they started the Grand Canyon. So while the Grand Canyon, Ben realizes that it's gonna take too long for him to go through the entire Grand Canyon to figure out what the secret could be. So he looks out into the difference and he says, I'm gonna eat it. I'm gonna eat the Grand Canyon of the United States. So, you know, America, we... So he gets to eat it. So, America, you know, we love our big food portions. And so meanwhile...
You can't just power through that.
Where is this going?
Okay, he's going to eat the Grand Canyon of the United States, which I hope he says exactly that, because yeah. No one calls it the Grand Canyon of the United States.
So,
are there any other Grand Canyons I should know about?
Oh, God.
So, the CIA operative Lucas Chambers has to stop Ben Gates finding out the government secrets and be played by Phyllis Rashad. I don't care. So, Ben has to start training with Man vs. Food host Adam Richman.
Okay. What's next?
I'm with you. I'm tracking.
Okay.
I'm tracking.
And seeing how he can be able to accomplish his goal. So, and then our B plot with Riley Poole is that he's getting help. He's trying to help Ben Gates by setting up cybersecurity so that he can have the whole park to himself and eat it. Riley Poole gets stopped by Edward Snowden. Edward Snowden tells Riley that the government can't let Ben Gates win for some reason, so they team up by starving the government. So Ben Gates is halfway through
eating. So Snowden is helping Riley prevent the government?
Oh, yeah. Oh, big time. And you can play him. You'll play Edward
Snowden. I'll be Snowden.
Yeah. Perfect. Yeah. So our B plot is, so Ben Gates is halfway through eating the Grand Canyon, and he finds this old chest, linking the point of the Grand Canyon to the Grand Canyon, the Zion, Yosemite, and Yellowstone. And it looks like some sort of river connecting. It's almost like a map. But this makes Ben Gates thirsty. So now he has to drink Old Faithful at Yellowstone National Park. The CIA kills Adam Richmond from Man vs. Food.
Okay.
Ben, Abigail, and Riley hide in Zion National Park. Edward Snowden tells them, "There's someone you should meet." Greta Thunberg shows up. I'm sorry. And teams up with them. Says that Roosevelt had set up a secret national park that is linking all of them together.
What?
And that the CIA is going to start fracking all of the parks and that we have to team up. And the secret park that's linking all of them is in Lincoln County, Nevada. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. The movie ends with them raiding Area 51,
oh
baby.
Oh, my gosh.
The secret national
park.
Wow.
That's my pitch.
That's what Area 51 is hiding. It's a secret. Brett. Wow.
All this,
just,
that's really
that
good.
Was,
that is, all this desert stuff is just a cover-up.
Oh,
it's a paradise.
My gosh.
That's my plan. Okay. Jared, take us home.
That is going to be hard to top.
That's, yeah. Wow. Greta Thunberg.
All right. Well, I'll give it a shot. Here goes
nothing.
Here goes nothing. Okay. Questions at the end, please.
Hold your applause.
So, National Treasure 3. The movie opens in a flashback sequence. The year is 1863. Confederate soldiers are moving north through Chancellorsville, Virginia, when we see one man accidentally fatally shot by his own army. We watch as Stonewall Jackson falls to the ground, grabs a nearby soldier by the collar, and utters in his dying breath, "They can never find it." Jackson dies.
What?
We then see what appears to be an anthropomorphic bullet remove itself from Jackson's chest and scurry away. So some time passes. It's 1864, and the Union Army in Georgia, led by William Tecumseh Sherman, marches through Georgia from Atlanta to Savannah, what we refer to as Sherman's March to the Sea. What we pick up in the flashback sequence here, and what Benjamin Gates and company will learn from primary source documents as the movie unfolds, is that Sherman originally planned to stop closer to present-day Macon, Georgia, in order to simply cut off Confederate communications. However, while there, they uncover a large cache of what appear to be metallic fossils.
Ooh.
It is only after this discovery that they adjust the plan to continue to Savannah. They simultaneously cut off Confederate supply lines at the coast and send this stash of what they perceive to be weaponry along with a supplemental battalion into the ocean around Florida to hide in the Gulf of Mexico in case the Civil War gets out of hand. They never need to use it.
What?
End of intro flashback sequence. Begin title credits.
So hold on, just I know you said save questions.
All right.
But are you just reading the script you've written? Because that's what it sounds like.
We're getting there. All right. So
act one.
Cut to interior.
So begin title credits. We open the film proper in April 2010. The Deepwater Horizon oil spill fills the Gulf of Mexico with millions of gallons of oil. Not only is this obviously an environmental disaster, but the CIA also gets intel that someone caused the spill to provide cover for the extraction of the 150-year-old cache of valuable metal and weaponry. After 2 to 3 years of futile efforts to discover fully what happened, the CIA is beside themselves and finally enlists the help of Benjamin Gates to find who could have done this and where the material has been moved to. In a meeting with the CIA, Benjamin Gates and company, so Riley and all them, are made privy.
Riley's back.
Riley is back. Are made privy to the information portrayed in the flashback. Insert some funny scene of banter between Riley and a low-ranking CIA official who matches him for wit.
Played by...
This is important. Hold up. Oh. Benjamin Gates remembers bedtime stories that his father used to tell him about magnificent animal creatures who helped the colonists and the French fight off the British in the Revolutionary War. He now thinks that there is more to the bedtime stories, has a theory as to what was in the Gulf of Mexico, and has ideas on who could have taken it. That same low-ranking official at the CIA tells him, "Dude, you should be the Indiana Jones of American history and have your own movies, or some other such fourth wall breaking irreverent wink to the audience that's so popular nowadays."
Is it Deadpool?
That official's name is Luke Hobbs, or Dwayne The Rock Johnson's character from the Fast and Furious franchise.
Oh, this is sick.
Come to find out, the terrorist organization Etienne has gotten their hands on classified plans for the Jaeger Initiative, of course, being the program put in place to build giant fighting robots to protect the world from the newly prominent kaiju who have started to burst out of the breach in the Pacific Ocean during the spring of 2013. Etienne does not want to protect the Earth, but rather fight alongside the kaiju with the superior technology that was hidden at the bottom of the Gulf of Mexico. How did Etienne learn about this technology, you might be asking? Well, we have to take you back to 1895, when Archibald Witwicky discovered the location of Megatron in the Arctic Circle.
I knew it!
Kicking off the series of events that led to the United States' knowledge of the Allspark and the Optimus Prime saga of the Transformers documentaries we all know and love. When the Autobots and Decepticons made their way to Earth in 2007, Etienne became fascinated with the technology of this living metal, which, of course, has its origins in the sonic canyons of the planet Cybertron. Some call this substance protomatter or sentio metallico. We're just going to go with transformium. In the aftermath of the first Transformer battle on Earth between Optimus Prime and Megatron, Etienne Intelligence scanned for the existence of transformium across the world, found pay dirt in the Gulf of Mexico. So, almost done. As it turns out...
No, I'm interested.
Yeah, no, keep going.
As it turns out, Benjamin Gates was correct. We learn through the movie from the traditional system of clues that lead to other clues, that lead to drawings, schematics, and previously thought to be destroyed primary source documents, that prior to the 2007 Optimus Prime saga, the Maximals and Predacons had been in North America for over 250 years. For those unfamiliar, Maximals and Predacons are from Transformers Beast Wars, which are essentially Transformers, but they're animals instead of vehicles.
Yeah. Oh, I thought we were going to go a different route, but keep going.
The puzzle pieces fill in. The Revolutionary War was won with the help of the Maximals. Predacons in the southern colonies died out, which helped to secure the northern victory. And traces of living metal became these metallic fossils that Sherman discovered in Georgia. Of course, we hearken back to the beginning of the film and understand the foreshadowing of the Stonewall Jackson anthropomorphized bullet.
Yeah.
Right. So Benjamin Gates and the CIA, including an overly eager Luke Hobbs, are tasked with taking down Etienne before they can create unstoppable Jaegers made from transformium. By the end of the movie, they, of course, succeed. The Jaeger Initiative goes off without a hitch. A new museum is added in D.C. commemorating the Transformers' various assistances throughout American history, and the large stores of remaining transformium are used in United States infrastructure with the futuristic vision of up-and-coming technological entrepreneur Elon Musk.
Oh, nice.
However,
End of Act 1.
Etienne escapes with enough of the material to see a smaller-scale project to completion, Operation Snowflake, the programmable super virus that is the subject of the Fast and Furious adjacent film Hobbs and Shaw. So, with one movie, we have National Treasure 3.
Uh-huh.
We have a prequel to Hobbs and Shaw.
Yep.
We have made room for a Pacific Rim 3 Transformers Beast Wars crossover movie.
That everyone has been pining for.
And once again, we see Benjamin Gates preserving American history and artifacts all for the love of the game. In the final pre-credit scene, we see Riley once again scolding Benjamin for being too modest. We learn that Gates did not allow the CIA to give him his own zoo comprised of Maximals that were recreated from their fossilized form. Disgusted at Benjamin's humility, Riley rides off on a Maximal cheetah. Roll credits.
It's in the way that you use it.
I thought mine was going to be too absurd with time travel to the Kennedy assassination, but you two...
Hey, I think everyone's doing good. I think we just need to get the whiteboard out, get a cup of coffee. I think we've got it. Fire those writers.
Cup of coffee. Just one cup.
You just
got
to smash them all together. Jared, I think we got a winner.
Of course, like the Statue of Liberty is a Jaeger, right?
It was
like the first Jaeger.
The proto Jaeger.
Yeah.
Proto
Jaeger. Well, perfect.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, Elijah.
Well, hold on. So I do want to ask, and I meant to point this out.
Oh, okay.
You said save questions for the end.
Great.
Okay.
What's your big line? From yours.
Oh.
Because
we're
going to
confuse the entire audience.
Because I feel like with combining all of those things, you have to have some.
Because
I'll be honest, that's where my mind went first, is I was like, what is some great, what's the most national treasure-y trailer line?
Yeah.
And built from there.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking too.
Without Optimus Prime's help, we can't beat the kaiju. Is that?
That's pretty good.
No, that's a great question.
You can think on it if you want. Because I have to say, well, Elijah, thank you again for coming on the show.
No, thank you all for having me.
Yeah. Well, with Most Extreme Podcast, all of our guests get a gift. And we have a gift for you. However, it is still in transit, so it is not here. So I'm just going to find a way to get it to you. Okay. What I have is... a script.
Oh no.
It's not the movie we made.
Okay, I was about to say, please let it be.
But this isn't just any script. It has an invisible map on the back. It is the script for National Treasure. However, it has been signed by the cast.
No way!
Yes,
what?
It has been signed by Nick Cage, Diane Kruger, Sean Bean, John Voight, and Harvey Keitel.
Oh my god!
So what? It'll be on your way, and I have to give it to you. So
that's incredible.
That is so cool. Thank you.
Yeah,
oh my god!
Sure. Thanks for coming.
Have
on the
me
show.
Back any other time. No, honestly, though, this has been I love just talking dumb stuff about movies, particularly fun movies from my childhood. So this has been awesome.
Well, thank you so much.
It was fun having you.
And anything you want to plug?
I have a podcast with my neighbor friend, Emily Witt, called Cover to Cut, where we also talk about movies, but we talk about we read the book and then watch the film adaptation of the book and then just kind of talk about the differences between the two. And it's a lot of fun. There's, I think, three... when's this planning on coming up?
December.
In December. So by then, we will have 4 episodes, I want to say.
Okay.
We did a Twilight Zone Halloween special where we read the short stories that inspired Twilight Zone episodes. And also, as Brett mentioned earlier, I'm on the CW show Legacies, which is returning... Oh, in January. I want to say January 14th. I should probably know that. It's my show, but I think it's January 14th. So, watch that.
Watch it. Absolutely. All right. Yeah. And, if you like what you heard, follow us on Twitter, Instagram. We have the handle Most Extreme Pod. And if you have any questions, email us at mostextremepodcast@gmail.com. Other than that, we'll see you next week.